WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Jazz bassist Ron Carter is among the most original, prolific, and influential bassists in jazz, with more than 2,000 albums to his credit. Beginning his career in the 1960s with Jackie Byard and Eric Dolphy, Cannonball Adderley, and a five-year stint with the Miles Davis Quintet, Ron Carter also performed and recorded with notables including Bill Evans, B.B. King, and Dexter Gordon. He joins us to discuss his latest album, An Evening With, and I'm going to try this, Ron, live at the Theater Stubchen Castle, and his upcoming performances this month at Birdland. Welcome back to the show.
So far, so good.
Now, I was sort of blown away by the fact that you have more than 2,000 albums to your credit?
2,221 as of 5 months ago.
How on earth is that possible?
Well, I've been making records since 1959.
I mean, and that was still, even the scientific, that's a lot of work.
At the time, there were four or five labels who were major labels in New York recording jazz. The four or five labels from Japan who would come over and record jazz, and from Europe. So there was always a lot of industry available to make those kinds of opportunities available for good players, and I happen to be one of those people.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of the clip that we introed this segment to?
I did a concert in Kassel, Germany, with a Donald Vega piano and Russell Malone guitar, and we will be, by the way, if I can say this plug out loud, at Birdland tonight, which is tomorrow, which is the 17th of October through the 21st, two sets a night, 8:30 and 11. And you hear songs just like this one, which was Laverne Waugh by the great bassist Oscar Pettiford.
I brought that up because I was watching you as it was playing over our headphones. You were staring out into the distance, and you were sort of nodding your head. Where did you go when that was playing?
I was hoping we could play as well as that sounds in the disc Tuesday night.
So let's talk about your career. You're known as a jazz bassist, but what was your first instrument, and when did you pick it up?
I played cello when I was about 11 or so. The teacher walked into our early grade school, up to the eighth grade, and she had this table full of instruments, and she said, "Okay, I'm going to start an orchestra at this school." It was when the schools were segregated, so it was an all-black school and all-black kids. And she said, "We're going to have an orchestra here. Here are some instruments. Pick one you like, and we'll start an orchestra." And the cello seemed to be the easiest to get a sound from, first of all. I thought I had some chances to make it do something different, you know, and that started it.
Where did these instruments come from? This was during segregation, as you mentioned, so where did they find the instruments?
She found a way to collect a couple of trombones, a trumpet, a cello, a couple of violins. She found a way to make this music available to us.
So you picked the cello, you said, because it was the one you could get a sound out of.
Yeah.
Did your parents encourage you to play music, and did they like you playing the cello?
Well, I think my parents were open to any opportunity we felt. I'm from a family of eight, six sisters and a brother. I'm from a family of parents who encouraged us to do things that were interesting for us to do. They were viable, to make it possible to get it done. They could afford to help us do it vis-a-vis the lessons and buying the instruments, in this case for me. I think that they were surprised that I showed this level of interest and matching talent.
So there was no specific instrument they wanted you to play.
No.
Like, you came home with the cello, and they were like, "Oh, we wanted you to play the violin or the trumpet or the drums."
Nothing
like that.
No.
So then, do you remember when you got your big break?
Well, I'm still looking for it, I think.
I think you've had your big break. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about your 2,200 and something albums that you have credits on.
You know, I never think of my career. That's, again, I think I'm happy to have continued having one. And I never think of an explosive moment or a light bulb for the jazz community to recognize me as someone who could help their music do something maybe a little bit different than someone else who they would hire. I've had some, I guess, landmarks, as the historians would call it, hysterians would call it. But I just don't think of my being wherever I am in the spectrum as a moment. Mm-hmm. I've always treated these various jobs with whoever they're with as a free school. I get a chance to see how this leader, whoever it is, Miles or J.J. Johnson or Cannonball or Bill Evans or Art Farmer, I get a chance to see how they react to an audience, how they change the program depending on the audience's response, or how the band sounds that night, or how they feel. And this is a free education every night. How they pick the tunes, how they pick the tempo. And I hope that the people who come to see the trio at Berlin will get a chance to see a combination of all these ingredients from three guys.
So since you brought him up, Miles Davis, how did you get into the Miles Davis Quartet? Quintet.
Well, it was a quartet till you hired me.
Okay.
I was working with Art Farmer at a club called the Blue Note when it was really downtown. Spring and Hudson, as a matter of fact, mm-hmm. not far from here. And he walked up to me after the first song, during an admission, and said that he was putting together a new band. He explained that the group he had was the piano player and Wynton Kelly and Paul were going to join the West Montgomery Quartet Trio. And he was looking for a bass player, and he thought that if I was available, he would hire me. Well, I called him Mr. Davis, because I didn't know him other than, I would never call him Miles. Mr. Davis, I have a job right now. I'm playing with Art Farmer. Mm-hmm. And I'm having a great time doing that. But if you'll ask Art Farmer if he will release me from my other commitment, which is a two-week gig, if he says yes, I'm happy to go. If he says no, I'm happy to stay with Art. And he talked to Art, and Art was, first of all, pleased that I would just not leave him in the lurch for the great Miles Davis, and that I would ask him for permission to leave. And Miles was surprised that I didn't jump at his offer, because I had a job, and it's just, I was responsible to Art Farmer. And that kind of set the tone for our relationship through up to his passing, you know. And Art said okay, and Miles said okay, we'll leave him the day after tomorrow for California for 6 weeks. So I borrowed a suitcase and headed to California with the band.
Wow. And at the time you were recording with those guys, it was Miles, Herb Hancock, Tony Williams, Wayne Shorter. Did you realize that this music you were all making was something special, something exceptional?
I think no one recognized that level of acceptance by the community at large. We knew it was different because we were all different people from those who were doing the main stuff, you know, and we were experimenting every night. We were never quite sure how it would turn out, but we had fun making mistakes and fixing them. But I think none of us expected that it would be that space, that rank of the musical groups that were important to the time.
You know, earlier you were talking about how, you know, performing with all of these people, you learned so much.
Absolutely.
I think you called it a master's class.
Yeah.
What do you think the people you performed with learned from you?
That I bring integrity to the music, if I can get the word out, integrity to the music. I come prepared to play. I learn the material. I trust their judgment. And I have a great time.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, WNYC.org. And I'm speaking with Ron Carter, the famed jazz bassist Ron Carter, about his career. And so you play the bass, but a lot of people now are turning to the electric bass, and you are sticking with the acoustic bass.
Yes.
Why?
Well, you know, I played electric bass for a while in New York at the time when the electric bass was just not making a splash on the scene. Producers never know whether they wanted upright or electric. So all of us who had upright bass went out and bought a new Fender, and we had to learn how to play that for these commercial gigs we're doing. But the fact of the matter is, those guys really played that bass well, even way back then. And of course, as the bass got more exposure and got more guys played it, the level of the electric bass players went through the roof, as it still does. Hmm. I thought that I had spent all this time trying to find my sound on the upright bass. I'd done all the experimenting I cared to do. I learned how to maintain an instrument, how to get it repaired, the library, how to play changes, how to learn melodies. I thought that for me to stop that, to be competitive with this other instrument, I'd have no chance. So I decided I would just kind of plod my way along, and maybe if I find something to do on bass that no one else is doing.
Is there a difference in sound between the electric bass and the acoustic bass?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'm trying to not visualize, but I don't know the word for like here.
You know what an English bowler hat looks like?
Yes.
You know what a baseball cap looks like?
Yes.
That's the difference.
Clever, very clever, because I was hoping you would actually try to give us some sounds of what they sound like. I've also discovered that there is this thing called the piccolo bass.
Yes, yes.
What is that?
Well, you know, when I first became a band leader, as all bass players insist on doing at some point in their career, I wanted to be sitting out in front of the band, because when you walk into a club or an environment, whoever's in front of the band is assumed to be the band leader. Right or wrong, that's what the view is. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if I was playing the bass in the trio, piano, bass, and something else, generally I'd be known as another sideman and not the leader. So I ran into Richard Davis, my dear friend, knew of a bass maker who lived in New Jersey. So he introduced me to this person. And I told him what I wanted to do. I wanted a bass that was a little smaller than the big bass, but bigger than the cello, that would literally place me physically in front of the band so I could conduct the band and look like the band leader.
Mm-hmm.
So he made this bass for me. I call it a piccolo bass, and it's tuned up a fourth from the regular bass, so it's higher in range from the big bass, but kind of dark for the cello, and it fit very well. The first bass player I played was Buster Williams, and we had some great times. And I think that that's kind of the identity of my nonet, which is four cellos and piccolo mm-hmm. bass. And it's kind of made a place in music, I think.
So you are jazz. You are in the jazz world, but I was surprised to learn that you also performed with symphony orchestras.
Yeah,
like two completely separate disciplines. What have you learned from symphony orchestras that you bring to jazz, and vice versa? What from jazz did you bring to your playing with the symphony orchestras?
Well, I think my classical experience has made me understand how to practice productively. You know, I was taking lessons every week as at 10, 12 years, 11 years old, 12. You have to prepare the lessons every week. And I had four things. I had a family of eight, and I had my chores, I had stuff to do, and more everybody's lawn within four blocks from my house, that kind of stuff, you know. And so I learned to practice productively so I could prepare for the lesson, and I maintained that concept, that style, that discipline. I think what I brought to the classical was a jazz player, is how to play different rhythms and comfortable with the fact that the bass, the jazz bass physically, has made big changes for the classical bass player who is not aware of how this influence comes from. So I'm happy to carry that flag for my fellow bass players.
The 1 minute that we have left or so, I have to talk to you about contemporary music.
Okay.
You're not a fan of contemporary artists sampling and taking things, hooks and lines and things from jazz to put into their own music, are you?
No, I don't mind them doing it. My concern is that they don't want to pay for it. You know, and I think what I'd like to see them do is have us play with them live to really change what they do, to really add a big dimension, another big dimension to their rapping and the scratching. I think a bass note with a certain key, it's going to change the tone of their voice. It will change the tone of the scratching. It makes them have another harmonic option that they're not really aware of because they don't have this kind of contact and exposure. I like to do that just to show them what the possibilities really are.
And you've performed with A Tribe Called Quest.
Oh, yeah.
What was that like?
No, they were really, really bright kids. I call them kids. They were interested to find out my theory. They said, is this going to work? I said, well, if you give me the lyrics in advance, I'll see what it does. And went to the studio and made the disc in about an hour and a half, and this rest is history.
I have to tell you, whenever I see a jazz performance, I am always looking at the bass player because that person, of all the people, that person is working the hardest, depending on what the piece is.
Absolutely.
And it is terrific to meet and shake the hand of a real live jazz bassist, Ron Carter. I've been speaking with Ron Carter, one of the most original, prolific, and influential bassists in jazz, with more than 2,000 albums to his credit, 2,221. As of last week. He is performing at Birdland through this Saturday, October 21st. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org/lowpate. Mr. Carter, thank you so much for joining us.